In one sense, that was satisfying, for it would be hard to understand how fragile human tissue could hold together if there really were signals rushing inside us at a million miles an hour. But it also was confusing, for the chemistry of that era still couldn't explain it. Eyelids are tugged down by muscles. Anatomists can easily find those muscles. But there are no little muscles acting as booster units to keep our numerous nerve signals going. And if our nerves were like telegraphs, where were the batteries and what exactly was inside the cables? There are no long strands of copper wire or any other metal inside our bodies. The solution the researchers were looking for, the explanation of how electricity can exist even when surrounded by water, appeared only when they stopped focusing on the machinery of the era. Telegraphs work by bouncing electrons around, but electrons, of course, are just one part of the atoms from which they come. Telegraphs and light bulbs and even computers have to rely on those small, vulnerable electrons. But our electrical technologies are a mere 2 centuries old. Evolution on Earth has been operating for billions of years, and long ago yielded another approach for conducting electricity, using not just tiny electrons, but entire atoms. The trick is to find atoms that have a greater than usual amount of electrical force leaking out. Normally, we're taught that doesn't happen, for there's as much negative charge in electrons orbiting an atom as there is positive charge in the nucleus at the atom's center. The result is that the whole atom is in a state of equipoise. That's why it's electrically neutral, and why even the great Newton sometimes thought of atoms as boring, simple spheres. Yet, in quite a few atoms, such as those of the common metal sodium, it's easy to tug off a single outermost electron. Our planet and bodies are loaded with these amputees. That's most convenient, for this galumphy giant is ideal at pushing other electrical charges along. It has one more positive charge in its own center than it has negative charges in its remaining electrons, so it beams out a strong positive electrical force field. Also, this big atom-sized sodium chunk, lacking one of the orbiting electrons that ordinary sodium has, can survive in places where tiny electrons cannot. It's impervious to churning water or reactive oxygen. Atom-sized ions like it can spend millions of years loose in the atmosphere, pummeled by wind and rain and electrical storms, or buried deep inside mountains, crushed under miles of rock. Individual electrons couldn't survive for long in the warm, sloshing water of a living body, but these giant reshaped fragments do fine. Any atom that has a different number of electrons than it normally starts with is called an ion, from the Greek for traveler. The snipped down sodium atom is called a sodium ion. This is what our bodies use to carry the currents Helmholtz measured. But how? Nerves are smaller than early anatomists thought they were. The white hollow tubes that Renaissance dissectors found are actually just conduits for the real nerves, which are much finer, almost like hollow threads, miniaturized far below ordinary vision. The narrowest part of all is the axon, the long stretching part of a nerve cell along which signals shoot. They're so small that even with modern microscopes, it's hard to see clearly inside most axons. Luckily for science, different nerves send signals at different speeds. If a nerve is very slender, the signal goes fairly slowly. If the nerve is wider, the signal goes faster. This meant that 20th century physiologists who wanted to improve on what the first German researchers had begun simply had to find creatures that needed ultra-fast nerve signals for their attacks and escapes, since that meant the creatures would likely have wide, plump nerves. The physiologists would also need pretty long creatures, since lengthy nerves would be easier to pull out. The logic's great, until one thinks what it means: hunting for huge, fast, living animals. Frogs would seem too small, bears could be too slow, but giant squid, or in lieu of that, ordinary squid, which need fast signals for their jet-propelled strikes, are ideal. First, of course, one had to find one squid. Alan Hodgkin, a gentle young English Quaker, had some difficulties when he returned to Plymouth, England in the summer of 1939 after a stint in the United States. He went out on trawlers, he scoured the fish markets, but where were the squid? In chatty letters to his mother, he tried to be positive, but then, despondent, he couldn't help bringing up the almost complete lack of squid. Yet by the end of July, his luck had turned. He went away for a week's vacation to Scotland, having asked local fishermen to keep on hunting, and they came through. On my return, found a large supply of squid waiting for me. The squid nerves that he and his even younger colleague Andrew Huxley pulled out dwarfed anything from more common creatures. These nerves were so big, almost as wide as a crisp pencil line, that they could stick a thin glass needle right down the middle of each one. The squid was dead, but the nerves were alive, in the sense that for several hours they still worked even without a host. The 19th century researchers could only measure along the length of a nerve, not see what was happening within. Hodgkin and Huxley, though, could now measure the electricity inside the nerve and compare it with the outside. At first, their experiments failed because the hollow needle scraped against the membrane. But Huxley was good with his hands, and eventually, with the help of some miniature mirrors to see upcoming bends, they could steer the needle without scratching the fragile, still-living nerve.